Everyone. Before we begin, I want to welcome the students who are here to watch the arguments. I know we have two groups of students from Gateway High School and also from East High School in Denver. The East High School students have won the state championship in the We the People contest and are headed off to the national finals. So we congratulate them and welcome all the students. All right, what we're going to do this morning, we have two cases we're hearing, so we're going to take a 15-minute break in between the two cases. If the attorneys from the first case are able to, I'm sure the students would enjoy being able to talk to you after the argument is completed. With all that preliminary, the first case up today is the People versus Owens, and we're ready to hear from the appellant.
Okay, please the court. My name is Dan Edwards. I represent the people of the state of Colorado. The issue before the court this morning is the constitutionality of a no extensions provision in the Unitary Review and Death Penalty Cases statute. The General Assembly enacted the statute so that both the direct appeal and post-conviction review would occur at the same time. Amongst the provisions were directions to this court or requests to this court that this court set certain time limits. And this court chose to do so in Criminal Rule 32.2. This court said, and the General Assembly as well said, that the purpose of the Unitary Review statute was to establish a fair, just, and expeditious procedure. Interestingly, this court also put in its purpose part of the rule in 32.2A that the rule was being enacted, quote, as directed by Section 1612.201, etc. The trial court found that the 2-year period was constitutional against separation of powers and due process challenges, but predicated that finding upon the extraordinary circumstances that this court put in a Rule 32.2. This court did not specifically put into 32.2 the no extensions of any kind provision that was in the statute. There are three issues that I would like to address this morning. The first issue is statutory construction, second issue separation of powers, and the third issue is due process. Concerning statutory construction.
I'm sorry. Did you mean the trial court found it unconstitutional or constitutional?
Found the 2-year period of time constitutional. Found the no extensions of any kind provision unconstitutional.
Thank you.
Mr. Edwards, one more question about the trial court's order. How do you interpret that in terms of whether it found the no extensions of any kind provision unconstitutional on its face, as applied, or both?
Well, it depends upon what constitutional provision we're looking at. If we're looking at separation of powers, that's always on its face. If we're looking at as applied, it appears that what the court ruled was on its face. However, based upon the appellate rule of right result, wrong reasoning, I think that as applied needs to be addressed as well. The reason we go to statutory construction.
Whoa, sorry. Over here. You got to run that by me again. Right result, wrong reasoning. And that means we have to get to the as applied challenge? Help me understand that. Is that what you're arguing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. What I thought I said was I will get to that particular provision. The court never has to go there. The reason we go to statutory construction first is statutory construction was something the defendant raised in his answer brief. But the reason we go there is because of the rule of constitutional avoidance. And so we look at statutory construction. When we look at statutory construction, the statutory construction not only applies to statutes, but it also applies to court rules. And when we're looking at statutory construction, the person challenging the statute has to prove that it's unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. We need to look at the plain and ordinary meaning of the statute or the rule. It must be considered as a whole. The defense argues that because this court in 32.2 did not mention the two-year period of time, that therefore the court did not adopt the two-year period of time. It's the people's position that that is not true. Going back to the purpose statement in the rule, 32.2, we have this court saying that 32.2 was adopted as directed by Section 1612.201 at SEC. And of course, that would include the time periods that are in 1612.208.
Yeah, but at the same time, we also had an extension provision here, at least in the briefing section, C2, for unseen circumstances.
That's correct, Judge. And it's the people's position that that extension period of time applies to a couple of different things. First, it applies, if we look at the time periods that this court enacted, the time period in the trial court adds up to 245 days. The time period in this court adds up to 365 days. So altogether, there is 120 days in the trial court unaccounted for. So any time that any procedure was finished early or during that 120-day period of time, the extraordinary circumstances part of the statute would fit.
Well, it seems to me, though, that the as directed was that we should adopt rulemaking, and this extension period doesn't say that it's within the 2 years. I mean, aren't we dealing with an effort here by two branches of government to make sure that it is speedy and efficient, but also that the due process problems, which I think exist, are addressed? And certainly we have the constitutional power to adopt rules and to make sure that we have just proceedings in the courts, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So didn't the trial court take into account this possibility for extension for extraordinary circumstances in ruling that the provision was constitutional?
Well, the trial court ruled that the two-year period of time was constitutional,
right,
but it was only constitutional if the extraordinary circumstances could extend the two-year period of time.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So why doesn't the rule say that?
Why doesn't the rule
say that? Why isn't the trial court exactly right about our rule?
The trial court is not right because this court said that you were adopting 32.2 as directed by statute.
Yes, the direction was that we should adopt rules. And when we adopt rules, we do that according to our constitutional authority and our duty as the third branch of government to assure due process. Isn't that right?
Well, we have to ensure due process, and we want to be fair to the defendant. But what this court said in 32.2 was that this procedure was being adopted pursuant to the statutory scheme. Part of the statutory scheme is the no extensions of time provision.
Regardless of impossibility to meet those, that time schedule, based on unforeseen circumstances, is that your position?
My position is...
No, we don't hear the case. We aren't able to accomplish the briefing in this court for whatever happens. Computer system goes out, the transcripts aren't prepared, whatever happens. We can hold no oral argument, make no decision if we're beyond the 2 years.
The General Assembly enacted a hard two-year cap. And it's our position that the court adopted that by the language of 32.2.
Mr. Edwards, let me just back you up a minute. Before Justice Hobbs started questioning you, I believe that you had said, using slightly different words, that the applying the time provisions in the court's rule and including extensions of time that might be granted pursuant to the court's provision with respect to that, that as long as those extensions in total, in aggregate, don't exceed 120 days, you're still within the 2 years. Did I understand you correctly?
That's part of it, Judge. But also, if any procedure is finished early, then that time period would be available as well.
Would add to the additional or the margin of time that might still allow this to happen within 2 years.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, with respect to your conclusion in your questioning with Justice Hobbs, you are essentially saying that when this court adopted a rule and said that its purpose, was because it was directed by the General Assembly, that that therefore implies that we have incorporated the entire statute somehow. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Isn't it also reasonable, and I think this is what the essence of Justice Hobbs' questioning was, and I'm not sure I understood your position, that we may have adopted that to the extent that we thought we could do so, given the constitutional constraints of due process, given the fact that we don't have the authority to adopt something that is not unconstitutional. Isn't that also a reasonable reading of as directed by the legislature?
Well, Your Honor, I would say it's reasonable but not correct.
Because?
Because this court, when it adopted that rule, said that as directed by Section 1612.201, which includes 208, which is the time periods and the hard two-year cap.
But as you pointed out, what do you do with the fact that, well, as you pointed out, we did not specifically adopt the two-year cap in the rule.
That's correct.
What do you do with that? Is that just set that aside, or does that have any significance?
I think the two-year cap is adopted by the court by the as-directed language. So that even though the court did not say 2 years, this court in adopted 32.2 said that this rule was being enacted as directed by that particular section, the unitary review statute, the entire unitary review statute, which included the two-year cap. This court could have said, we are adopting or as directed by sections 12208, except for the no extensions provision that is provided in 1612.208.
Mr. Edwards? Can I ask you, it seems to me you made the argument you just made, if you can't hear me, speak up, I'm sorry, about the hard two-year cap, and I understand your position. And then you also make the argument that it's not as applied anyway because the actual time limit, we haven't reached that, it's 610 days. But putting aside both those arguments, just for a second, what is your position with respect to this? The court struck down the extension, as you've mentioned, the trial court did, and it seems to me that that's a facial challenge. So if there are situations which would fall within that two-year cap that you're saying, that seems to me to take it out of the facial challenge. And the court is wrong. The trial court's incorrect. Now, what's your position about that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't understand the question.
Okay. If we have to presume the statute is constitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, and if we have to assume that there are literally no circumstances under which a statute can be construed to be constitutional, those are presumptions that we have to make, right? Okay, so if we look at the extension of that was found to be facially unconstitutional by Judge Rafferty, just look at that.
Okay.
It seems to me there are certainly cases, maybe not this one, where the unitary review system and process can be completed.
I'm sorry, cannot?
Can be completed within 2 years. And therefore, the judge's reasoning is incorrect.
To that extent, Your Honor, I would agree with your position that there are those cases that may be able to be resolved in the two-year period of time.
So why do we have to go further than that?
Well, Your Honor, I think I do, based upon the answer that was filed in this case. And the judicial principle that right result, wrong reasoning. So that there are cases, and I agree with the court, that could be resolved in 2 years. The Montour case, where there was a guilty plea and a sentencing hearing, could be resolved within that two-year period of time.
I'm a little confused here by the discussion, because I thought Judge Rafferty picked up on the extraordinary circumstances extension beyond 2 years. Did he or didn't he not?
He found that the two-year period of time was constitutional with the proviso that it was a soft cap,
right,
where there were extraordinary circumstances that would extend the two-year period of time.
At the trial court level and at our level, the total period of time, right?
the trial court judge found at the trial court level that it was a soft cap. As to any appellate procedure, the court found that he did not have jurisdiction to talk about time limits in the appellate court.
Okay, but he felt that he could grant extensions in the trial court.
Correct.
Based on some kind of finding of extraordinary circumstances.
Correct.
And in this case, the record seems to show that there were transcripts that hadn't been prepared yet. There were rulings. There was discovery. There was so on that would that justified. I think this goes to Justice Ide's question, extending what otherwise would be strict time periods to meet the 2 years. Is that what we have in front of us?
Yes, Your Honor, but there's a remedy for that. It does not make the statute unconstitutional. It does not make the statute unconstitutional. You have an unconstitutional statute if the statute is applied right. The statute and the rule have not been applied right. There are discovery issues, there are transcript issues. All that were supposed to be resolved, the discovery issue, I believe, within 5 days of the advisement, the transcripts within 21 days of the advisement or within 21 days of any subsequent hearing, that has not been done. And that's why in our reply brief, our position is this, that they are entitled to an equitable remedy, that it should be remanded, that the trial court should be directed to set a date certain to ensure that all those things that were supposed to be done, in this case a long time ago, are done before the time period begins to run.
Oh, okay. In other words, the time period doesn't, under that theory, hasn't started running yet.
Well, if this court finds that, the time period hasn't begun to run yet.
Mr. Edwards, how is your position that there is an equitable remedy that would, in effect, extend the time period beyond the 2 years? How is that appreciably different, or different in effect, from saying the statute is constitutional on its face, but in some circumstances it might be unconstitutional as applied unless there is an extension authority?
Your Honor, it's because what has happened here is violations of the rule. Because there have been violations by the rule at the trial court level, this court shouldn't find that the rule or the statute is unconstitutional, should remand it to make sure that the judge follows the statute and the rule.
I don't think that was Justice Martinez's question. His question was, why isn't that essentially the same thing, that judge just saying the statute's constitutional, but the judge has the authority in particular extraordinary circumstances to grant extensions of time in the trial court level?
Because to find that, the court has to find that, to go that way, to address constitutional issues, this court would have to find that the no extensions provision is unconstitutional. And pursuant to the principle of constitutional avoidance, this court can say, look, trial court, this has not been applied properly. Send it back down and make them apply it properly.
Well, but that seems a little inconsistent. I thought that's what Justice Martinez was getting at. In your reply brief, you talk about an equitable remedy. Isn't that the same thing?
No.
What's the difference? Well, how is that different?
It's different because the court would have to find something unconstitutional to say that it's a soft cap. The court would have to find the statute unconstitutional, the part that says no extensions. Well, instead of finding the statute unconstitutional because it has not been applied properly, it should be remanded to the trial court to apply it properly.
But the point is, the court, in your view, can't apply it properly now. It might have been able to apply it properly earlier, or some court in a future case might be able to apply it properly. But your equitable position seems to me says that because it wasn't applied properly in the past, it is now necessary on an equitable rationale to extend the 2-year period of time. Isn't that where you end up?
Well, I wouldn't say it the way the court is saying it. What I would say is that the period of time needs to be reset because the statute wasn't applied correctly.
But when you reset that time, what you mean by resetting the time, you mean that we changed the start date so that you now have, now you can make the time limits, right?
Correct.
What's the difference between changing the start dates and extending the finish date? I hear the words are different, but I'm having trouble understanding why that has a significant difference in some legal principle.
Well, because one way the court has to find that the no extensions provision is unconstitutional.
Right, and the other way we have to find that it's inequitable. Unconstitutional as applied versus inequitable in these circumstances. Again, different words. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is whether or not the statute's been applied correctly or the rule has been applied correctly. And in the trial court, the rule has not been applied correctly because the transcripts weren't prepared, this discovery wasn't provided. Those things that are supposed to happen within a short period of time after the unitary review advisement.
I think I understand your answer. Let me digress with just a more of a fact check here. And that is, do I correctly understand it that the court has not yet reached that point where it has extended time or restarted time in order to get past 2 years? It's approaching that, but has not yet done, it's granted a number of extensions, but has not yet exceeded the 2 years. Is that correct?
Judge, that is really a question because I'm not sure of the answer to that. There are transcripts. I don't know if there are transcripts outstanding. I know a lot of discovery has been provided. I don't know if all the discovery has been provided. I haven't actually been involved in the trial court procedures for about 6 months. I generally know that it has either been accomplished or is hopefully shortly going to be accomplished. But the way to do that under the statute is the time does not start running until the unitary review advisement. That doesn't start running until after the imposition of sentence. The imposition of sentence is continued so that the trial court makes sure that all those things are complied with before the judge imposes sentence. Then the unitary review statute could work.
Under the facts of this particular case, though, the sentence has already been imposed, hasn't it?
I'm sorry?
Under the facts of this case, has sentence been imposed?
Yes.
It was. And is that more than 2 years ago?
Going on in 2 years. It was December 08.
So not yet 2 years.
Right. It's about a year and 4 or 5 months.
So do I understand you think that the flaw in the handling in the trial court was that trial court should have all of its ducks in a row, so to speak, the transcripts prepared and all that before sentencing?
Before imposition of sentencing. The problem with the phrase imposition of sentence, it means different things and different rules and different statutes. Imposition of sentence in certain places means the jury verdict. Imposition of sentence in some places means the judge is actually setting an execution date. Imposition of sentence in another statute applies to the execution itself. So, but if the imposition of sentence is when the judge actually sets an execution date and imposes a sentence on whatever convictions there might be, if that's the imposition of sentence, then the court can continue that and has continued that in cases. The jury verdict in this case was in June of 08, and the court did not impose sentence until December.
So what's your definition of that term for the purposes of this case?
The imposition of sentence to make sense, to make it harmonious, to make it work, is the date that the judge sets the execution date.
Okay.
Counsel, before you move on, can I get you to respond to an argument that was made in one of the briefs, which is essentially this is all about nothing, that really the district court misunderstood that it was even bound by the statute and that it really is only bound by the rule, and that the statute really is only a direction to us. It has nothing to do with the district court. Can you respond to that?
Your Honor, I would agree with the defense, but for the language of 32.2A, which says that this court is enacting it as directed by that statute. And because this court decided to set in the time limits and the procedures in the statute, that that is something that this court was asked to do. So as long as you have the as-directed language, and you have to go back to 32.2A, if you go to that statute, it says as-directed in the statute.
Then can I ask you just a follow-up question? How do you read the district court's opinion in terms of this on its face and as-applied challenge? Do you think the district court invalidated it on both grounds, on one ground? I mean, can you help me read the district court's opinion?
I'm not sure that the district court ever used the words as-applied or on its face.
And that's why I'm asking you. I'm trying to figure it out myself, because it's obviously important to our review, I think, as Justice Bender says, on its face. I mean, you basically have to say there's no constitutional application that you can think of or that is possible, and then you could say it's unconstitutional on its face. And so it's obviously important to our review, and that's why I'm asking how you interpret the opinion.
Well, separation of powers has to be on its face. The due process, the judge does make certain findings about the length of the record, things like that. In his conclusions of law, I don't remember that he talks about the size of the record, and therefore this is the way it works out. What the court found was primarily in the length of the opinion, primarily found a separation of powers problem.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Edwards, he did say that this is the largest case in the history of the state of Colorado. It is fine.
Probably.
That sounds like as applied.
The judge does talk about that in his findings of fact.
Absolutely.
Sure.
He says the largest record. I think he said it took 4 months to try. I maybe.
Well, I think another thing that the court needs to look at is the resources that are put in a case like this by the Public Defender's Office and Alternate Defense Counsel. Currently, there are four post-conviction review counsel and four direct appeal counsel. So Mr. Owens is currently represented by 8 attorneys. If more resources are needed, I have looked and I've never found a case that had 4 attorneys doing post-conviction review or 4 attorneys doing direct appeal. Well, the Colorado has decided to do that. Well, if they can do 4, can they do 5? Can they do 6? Are there resources there?
Wasn't that partly due to a conflict of interest that was found with the Public Defender's Office?
Well, that's how alternate defense counsel got appointed. And if Public Defender's Office would have stayed on, if there hadn't been a conflict, I don't know how many attorneys the Public Defender's Office would have assigned. Usually the public defender, the trial court level, puts 3 attorneys on it. The alternate defense counsel in the trial level put 4 attorneys.
Mr. Edwards, this discussion about the resources devoted by the defense, is the point of this that the complexity and possibly the length of a prosecution like this is affected not just by the case and the prosecution, but also by the defense? Is that the point?
Yes, Your Honor, it would certainly take one attorney a lot more time than it would take 4 attorneys to discover and investigate and do post-conviction review and direct appeal.
Well, I thought you were saying the opposite. I thought you were saying the more attorneys, the longer it takes. But you're saying the more attorneys, the shorter, the quicker it could be that, huh?
Right. If you have 4 attorneys on reviewing 30,000 pages of transcripts and discovery and whatnot, then it certainly can be done at a quicker rate than if you assign one attorney.
Wasn't there also, Mr. Edwards, a problem with the discovery delivery by the district attorney, that it wasn't fully adequate and it was very lengthy and difficult?
That's correct. And one of the reasons for that is that there was a co-defendant. And so the prosecutors weren't available. The court wasn't available. Certain materials were being used as exhibits in the co-defendant's case. So no, they didn't have total access, and that's why it's one of the reasons why they should get equitable relief.
Mr. Edwards, I'd like to take you back real quick to a question about your construction of the language of the rule and the statute. The 2-year cap, as your talking about it comes from a sentence in 1612-208, right at the end, that says, "There shall be no extensions of time of any kind beyond 2 years."
That's correct.
The rest of that rule, the rule is entitled Supreme Court Rules, and throughout it, it talks about the Supreme Court. It says the Supreme Court will ensure the various things. So it tells us things to put in the rule. This one sentence does not, at least on its face. You seem to have construed it as telling us what to put in the rule in your interpretation that because we've adopted the rule pursuant to this statute, we intended to incorporate all the things they told us to do. I'm curious, is that a concession on your part to what I believe the defense partially argues, and that is the Supreme Court, the legislature has not set a two-year cap, but rather it has ordered us to set a two-year cap. And if that's true, what's the effect of us failing to do something that the legislature has told us to do, assuming we construe the statute differently or the rule differently from you? Any of that make sense?
Sure. Your Honor, I would go back to the as directed by the section. If you read that entire statute, that section in the statute, it talks about all the things that need to be accomplished. That is basically from the advisement to file the reply brief in this court has to be within 2 years. And then it says there shall be no extensions of time. Well, if you look at the paragraph says 2 years and no extensions.
And I guess, Mike, I understand, I think, what your construction is. I'm curious, does that mean then that you agree when they say there shall be no extensions of time of any kind beyond 2 years? They're not imposing that limitation. They're telling us to pass a rule to impose it.
That's correct.
And so at most, what would be at issue here is whether the rule is constitutional or has been violated, or is that right? Under your construction?
Well, our construction of the statute is that because this court adopted the as-directed language, it also adopted the two-year hard cap.
So you're saying that language not only directs us to pass a rule, but it also says there is a cap?
I think it says that this court is adopting the unitary review statute, including the time limits, including the no extensions.
Okay.
I see that my time is up. I thank the court.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Ripucci, attorney registration number 30069, appearing on behalf of the appellee, Sir Mario Owens. This court's asked a lot of difficult questions, and I want to try to get to them, as many of them as I can, because I think this is a difficult case. But I think that perhaps the first thing that the court needs to appreciate is, in fact, that we are dealing with not just one post-conviction order, but actually two post-conviction orders. And those are numbered PC Order 1, which was the July 24th order that is directly at issue in this appeal.
Excuse me, Mr. Ripucci, could you just speak a little louder?
Yes,
maybe
sir.
Pull
yes,
up the podium?
Yeah. I apologize.
If you could pull up the podium a little bit. Thanks.
So I guess my point that I think the court needs to understand, and it makes it a little bit difficult procedurally, is that the first order, the July 24th order, the judge says that the two-year period is constitutional, but only because this court's rule authorizes extensions of time beyond 2 years, meaning that the court can continue to grant extensions of time based on extraordinary circumstances if the defense is able to meet that showing. What happened was the prosecution filed this appeal. Thereafter, the issue came up as to whether or not the trial court continued to have any jurisdiction in this matter at this point. And we asked the court for a discretionary stay, and we asked the court to divest its jurisdiction to this court. The trial court denied that request, both of those requests, and when it did so, it actually changed the July 24th order. And the way it changed it was, it basically, if you read it very carefully, it basically reverts to an understanding that the two-year limit is in fact either jurisdictional or a hard cap. And thus the court has ruled, after this appeal was taken, that it can grant extensions of time only up into that point, that moment in time, when whatever that may be, that it feels that it can still perform the hearing, issue a ruling, and still get that all accomplished 5 days before the notice of appeal is due.
Mr. Rappucci, I'm sorry, may I interrupt? That was something that I was concerned about. So you're not saying that there was a second written order?
Yes, there is a second written
order. That is dated something other than July 24th?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the date of the second written order?
I believe it's September 30th, and it's titled PC Order Number 2. And I suspect that in the record that the court has, it's at the very end of the 10,000-page PDF of pleas.
And the way I read the July 24th order, Judge Rafferty said, that no extensions of any kind is unconstitutional, but the extraordinary is, as long as you can make some extraordinary extensions, it's constitutional. And what I'm now wondering is what you were saying happened in September. How did he change that?
How did I change that?
He, Judge Rafferty.
How he changed it was that under the July 24th order, he can continue to grant extensions of time without any temporal restrictions. He's not bound by the 2 years.
Right.
The September 30th order, and there was also a transcript on the hearing that was then converted to the written order, he has changed that order to say that he can grant extensions of time for extraordinary circumstances, but only up until that point in time where he believes...
2 years, at which point he loses jurisdiction, is that what you're saying?
Less than 2 years. Presumably sometime very soon, because we're going to need to have lengthy evidentiary hearings.
What did he say? I interrupted you. He can only grant...
I'm sorry?
I won't interrupt you again. Please just answer my question.
He said that he has authority under the rule to grant extensions of time, but only up until that point in time, whenever he decides that is, that he will be able to rule on the motion, conduct evidentiary hearings, rule on the motion, and then still be in a position to have that ruling come up to this court prior to 2 years.
But he didn't give you a date.
No, the order does not give a date. I think one important, and so we asked this court to grant, we filed a Rule 21 motion petition and asked this court to assume full jurisdiction because of this second order, which we firmly believe, and I think the record bears out, changes the order that was now up here. This court denied that Rule 21, denied to grant a stay.
So a jurisdictional question. So it would it seem then to you that the first order is before us on appeal? The second order is not directly before us on appeal.
It's very difficult. Your Honor, that's a very difficult question to answer.
Well, this is an interlocutory appeal from the first order, is that right?
It's not really any, I'd be careful in using the term interlocutory appeal, but yes, it is a prosecutorial appeal under the URS, which is the statute we're talking about, to this court based on July 24th order. It's not an appeal based on the subsequent order, which quite frankly should have never occurred because it changed the order that's before this court, and that's why we ruled 21 then.
Mr. Rappucci, I have some minute orders, but they're dated October 26th, not November 30th.
September 30th.
And September 30th.
There's more than a minute order. There's a lengthy order. It's probably a six-page order.
Okay. And then to follow up on Justice Martinez's question, the September 30th order which you say changes the July 24th order, is not before us. That's your first point. Is that correct?
I do not think that it's technically before this court because it wasn't appealed, but I don't think this court can, in good faith, ignore it.
Okay, so let's move on to my second point. And exactly how does it change the July 24th order?
Exactly how it changes the July 24th order is that under the July 24th order, there are no temporal restrictions in terms of the trial court's ability to grant extensions of time. Under the subsequent order, that authority to grant extensions of time under the rule is circumscribed by that moment in time that the judge, in his own collective wisdom, thinks that he can still get everything done in order to get this to the post-conviction matter to this court within 2 years.
When he can get the 35C, the post-conviction remedy hearing done.
Done, ruled on, and still give 5 days to the defense to file a unitary notice of appeal. And so I think what the court needs to stop and think about is the fact that where we're at now with this ruling is very far afield from the statutory language. It's not remotely close. I mean, the statutory language discusses finishing the record, the proceedings, and the notice of appeal, and the briefing within 2 years.
You mean the briefing in our court?
Yes, Your Honor.
And yeah.
So your point is that going beyond the 2 years is inevitable, is what you're
saying? Yes, it will happen. Unless the only way it doesn't happen is if this court cuts it off. Somehow we're cut off. The whole proceedings are cut off, jurisdictionally, I suppose, at the two-year point. And everything is awash. Mr. Owens doesn't get to do appeal. He doesn't get to do post-conviction relief. He doesn't get to do federal habeas corpus.
Let me ask you one more jurisdictional question. That is, do you think the trial court had jurisdiction to issue the second order, thereby changing the first order that was on appeal before us?
No, I do not think the trial court had the jurisdiction. And we did Rule 21 that on precisely that issue, that Rule 21 was denied.
I'm sorry, I want to pop back to me if you wouldn't mind. There, looking at these minute orders, it appears that something else happened in this case on 12-21-09. What was that? December 21st.
Things have been ongoing in this case since July, not just on that date. I don't think that I can speak as we stand here. I don't recall.
Okay. But nothing with respect to the issues before us, as far as you can recall.
As far as, if we talk about them in a narrow sense, no.
So the last...
Or tinkering.
Excuse me, once again. So the last thing we're really dealing with is this amendment, the September 30th order.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Could I just get one clarification? I got a little lost there while you were explaining the difference between the two orders. Let me just ask it this way. Was there something in the second order you're referring to that would retract or undo the court's order that this provision is facially unconstitutional?
No.
And is that what the people have a right to appeal from?
Well, actually, let me back up. I don't think that the court's order from July 24th is based on facial grounds. I don't see how the court...
Well, let me drop out the facial, but it's unconstitutional.
Correct. That has not been changed.
And that is what the statute provides for an immediate appeal from. Is that not right?
Correct.
Statute does not provide for an appeal from a construction of the statute or particular acts of the court that would not hold inoperable or unconstitutional a statute. Is that right?
I think that the... perhaps it depends if we are proceeding under 1612-207. I believe that statute, I'd have to check it, but I think that it would allow an appeal if the statute is found inoperable.
I think that is true.
As well as unconstitutional. But
this is the people's appeal, and so what we're on appeal from is what they have filed a notice of appeal from. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, yes, at this juncture, yes.
So you're going to help us out and tell us how the statute can be constitutional?
I am going to do my best to help you out on that. I think it sort of does get back to Justice Ide's comment, and I think Justice Coates' question is this all to do about nothing? There's a very simple path to resolving this situation, which furthers the goals of constitutional avoidance, and that is to read the statute for what it is. And what the statute is a directive, specific directive to this court to pass a rule that ensures that all of these things will be done within 2 years and to not include any and no exceptions. That's the directive to this court. And that is an unconstitutional directive on separation of powers ground. The legislature cannot tell this court in mandatory terms what to do with its rules. It simply cannot. And that's exactly what 1612.208.3 does. And what it actually says is that this court shall pass rules to ensure that these things occur within 2 years, no exceptions, no extensions of time of any kind beyond the 2 years. This court passed a rule, and it incorporated a lot of the URS in it. It passed the enabling rule. It did mostly as it was told to do, not asked to do, told to do. But what it did not do is it did not include a no extension provision. Quite the contrary. It included an extensions provision for extraordinary circumstances that could not be foreseen or prevented. And where that really leaves us is either this court interprets the statute as being a directive to this court that was not followed. And I suspect the court has the authority to do that. I mean, the statute was very clear. It told the court what to do, and the court didn't do it. So if the court's reasons for not doing it were that we would be standing here arguing about it, which I suspect they were, then we really get into the separation of powers problem. I mean, this court doesn't want to confront the legislature. The legislature doesn't want to confront this court. But sometimes it happens. And it may be that the only way to deal with this situation is head-on separation of powers. I think that claim is clearly dispositive. But I do think that what the rule, we do need to look at what the statute actually says. It says, court, Supreme Court, you shall pass this rule. You shall not include extensions. That this court didn't pass that rule. It passed a different rule. And so that's where we have the conflict. We're talking about procedural time limits here. We're talking about filing deadlines. That's procedural. Under McKenna and all of this court's case law, Boer v. Lewis, there's a long line of it. If there's a conflict and the conflict deals with procedure, then the rule controls. And so I think that's a long-winded way of saying that in a lot of ways, Judge Rafferty kind of got it right. His end result, at least in the first order, is right. Is that he should be going forward under 32.2, and under that rule, he has authority to grant extensions without any temporal restrictions, with no 2-year limit. He can do that so long as the circumstances warrant it and the defense makes his showing. And if we get to that point, this appeal is over. But it's critical, it's very critical for this court not to lose sight of the fact that this is, in fact, a capital case. Mr. Owens is facing the death penalty. It's been imposed.
Well, let's assume that the General Assembly knew that. Let's assume that they were talking, you know, precatory, aspirational, that they did envision cases where 2 years could be complied with all the way through briefing in this court. I mean, that's certainly possible. And, of course, the milieu when they passed this was that we had a different sentencing scheme. Judges were going to do the sentencing, which subsequently was ruled unconstitutional by this court based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision, right?
Correct.
So they were looking at maybe a more expedited process where all of, you know, all of this could be accomplished within 2 years. So why don't we follow the language here that's in the purpose and scope of our rule, which I think mirrors the statute, fair, just, and expeditious. which means, of course, and we have to also understand that they took an oath to the Constitution. They understand the separation of powers, that to the extent it can be accomplished, they wanted it accomplished, and they wanted us to put in timelines. But recognizing our authority, that we did, in fact, adopt a rule that didn't have a hard and fast unconstitutional, let's assume, because in some cases you're not going to meet the two-year period. Now, can't we ascribe the General Assembly's motive and the background that they enacted this to say, okay, this is in your bailiwick, but this is what we'd like to see happen, to the extent you can accomplish it within the judicial system, 2 years?
If I understand the court's question correctly, I think the answer is you've got it exactly right. If the 208.3 is merely aspirational and advisory and a statement telling you this is what we want to see happen, I think this court passed the rule with the idea that this is, in fact, what would happen.
Well, if you look at the language, though, I mean, it doesn't seem to be aspirational. I mean, the sentence reads, there shall be no extensions of time of any kind beyond the two-year period. There's nothing aspirational or suggestive about that language.
Well, that I would agree that there is nothing aspirational about that language. I'd also disagree with that as being what the language actually says, because I think that the court, in reading it, overlooked the first clause, which is that shall. I mean, it's a longer sentence than.
There are lots of other clauses, but the sentence itself just says, there shall be no extensions of time of any kind beyond the two-year period.
That is what that
That's what that sentence says. And that sentence is kind of appended to this whole section. I mean, it's oddly set up, if that's what you're saying. I certainly agree with you there. 1612.208 goes through all of the things that the Supreme Court is supposed to do, 1, 2, all the way down, and then ends up with this particular sentence. And the sentence does seem to sort of come from out of nowhere. But the sentence itself is very directive, very specific.
I don't disagree with Your Honor. And I think therein lies...
Well, now, but you have, don't you have to look at the legislative declaration that says that the purpose of the unitary review statute is to allow, quote, full and fair examination of all legally cognizable post-conviction and appellate issues by the trial court and the Supreme Court?
I'm not sure I understand Your Honor's point.
It appears that the legislative declaration contemplates that the statute is intended, and we have to look at all parts of the statute, construe it harmoniously, look at the legislative intent. It says that its purpose, 1612.201, 2C, is to allow the full and fair examination of all cognizable post-conviction and appellate issues by the trial court and the Supreme Court.
And that can't happen with a two-year cap.
Well, no, so that we have to construe the two-year cap in the context of the entire rest of the statute, which gets at justice and fairness and due process as well. I mean, we read it like that or not? Can we temper that what they meant was that in cases where it can be accomplished, the 2 years should be held to? And that is, in fact, what we tried to do with our rule.
I can't answer that question as to what this court can or cannot do. If this court can do it, it sounds like the right thing to do.
Let me ask you this then. What about the 35C comparison in Wiedemer that Judge Rafferty was concerned about? I mean, that seemed to be what really kicked him over into holding this statute unconstitutional.
Well, I think you raise an interesting point, and I think this is something else that this court needs to deal with and recognize, is that essentially Judge Rafferty has interpreted 208.3 as some sort of amorphous quasi-statute of limitations. We believe that's clearly wrong, a misinterpretation.
Okay.
The statute of limitations in the URS is 1612.209. And the reason I know that is because it's titled Limitations. And that is very clear, 209.1 is very clear that it says that the timing will be based on the Supreme Court rule. So to the extent that we've gone embarked on this course of interpreting 208.3 as having any application to the parties, to the district court, to the proceedings below, it's wrong. That's not what the statute says. That statute was directed to this court. And so I guess...
So you think it's unlike 35C, where it's jurisdictional. You think
correct.
The only thing that's jurisdictional is 1612.209, which doesn't set out a time period. Was I confusing in my question?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm not prepared to say that 209 is jurisdictional.
I see.
I don't know the answer to that. I think it's very important that this court recognize, in not only in thinking about this case, but in dealing with it and resolving the issue, a clear statement that 208.3 is not jurisdictional. And the reason that's important, it's critical, because what we're doing down below is running around in a sense of absolute panic and chaos because nobody knows what 208.3 means. And if 208.3 is jurisdictional, or if it's an absolute time bar, as the prosecution has suggested, at least initially, then we are in a situation where there's going to come a point where all of a sudden we've crossed the threshold and Mr. Owens gets no post-conviction review, no direct appeal review, and no federal habeas.
This would have been easier if that sentence that I have been reading to you was in the 1612.209 section as opposed to the 208 section.
I'm not sure it would have been easier.
Well, as opposed to a directive to the Supreme Court to adopt a rule, it would have said this is a limitation on post-conviction review, and if it didn't take place in 2 years, you couldn't have it.
I think then we'd be talking very clearly about whether or not the legislature had the jurisdiction to, whether or not the legislature had the authority to essentially take an ongoing case and cut its jurisdiction off at the knees based on the past.
I understand, but the essence of your argument is that we should just basically disregard the 208 language.
Right.
I mean, maybe I'm overstating your position, but or am I?
I think it's difficult for the court to simply disregard it. I do think it's difficult for the court to simply disregard it. But I'd also note that in enacting the rule, it seems as though the court did disregard it already. I'm not sure what that means. I mean, I think if the court cannot disregard it, if the court does not have authority to disregard it as advisory, then the court needs to deal with it. And it brings it square head-on into a separation of powers. It's unavoidable at that point. So if there's a way to avoid it, short of that, that accomplishes, you know, I think that would solve a lot of the constitutional problems.
Well, otherwise, we in the U.S. Supreme Court are looking at a 14th Amendment due process violation, right? I
mean, absolutely.
I mean, he's entitled to an appeal.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you a question about that. Let's try to bracket your argument in terms of what the limitations on the legislature are. Could the legislature constitutionally take away the defendant's right to appeal?
Do you mean all defendants?
I mean all this defendant in a death penalty case, whichever.
Well,
can the legislature constitutionally?
No.
Is there authority for that?
I would say the Equal Protection Clause is probably...
Well, haven't we said for over a century that the right of appeal is not constitutionally guaranteed?
Right, but you can't... I don't believe that you can give it to everybody else and cut it off for a capital defendant. And I don't think that the capital jurisprudence supports the concept of an appeal not being constitutional in a death penalty case.
And so the basis for it would be the distinction between capital cases and other cases in which an appeal would be allowed. Is that right? You'd be in effect saying, what would that be? Would that be a compelling interest type of test, and the legislature doesn't have any compelling interest for treating capital defendants differently?
These are some of the precisely the issues that are ongoing right now in the court below. It wouldn't just be equal protection. It would be a right to, not just a right to appeal, it'd be a right to counsel. And it would totally infringe on it, because everybody else would have a right to counsel and appeal except for capital defendants.
Well, I agree with you there. I mean, I think we have said, probably Evitz v. Lucy in those cases probably say, if you're going to give a defendant an appeal, he's entitled to counsel and it's got to be effective. But what I'm curious about, we seem to have here a limitation on what kind of an appeal you could have or how long it could go. And I'm trying to bring it back and say, well, you're saying the legislature couldn't order us to limit it to 2 years in briefing, or couldn't limit it itself to 2 years. Could it simply take away the appeal and let the defendant go to the federal courts for his appeal?
I think it could do that potentially if it did that for every felony defendant in Colorado. Okay. Short of that.
So it'd be a question of where they drew the line. If they drew it only at capital defendants, then you'd say that would be
I think the Supreme Court's precedent is that that there's not a constitutional right to an appeal. But if you're going to give an appeal, it has to be done with due process. So if Colorado was prepared to cut off appeals for everybody, we might be able to do that.
Can I bring you back to Mr. Edwards' arguments? And as I understand, his argument is that there ought to be an equitable tolling because the trial court was unable to comply with the limitations on how long it takes to get a transcript prepared and things like that. What's your position?
Well, my position on that is that's not what the statute doesn't authorize that sort of equity. The statute simply doesn't. And 2083 doesn't. It says no exceptions of any kind. So to the extent that the prosecution has conceded that the statute hasn't been followed and it's been misapplied, which it has, to the extent that the prosecution has conceded that Mr. Owens is entitled to equitable relief, I agree with that. But the problem I see is that it's very inconsistent to say 2 years, no exceptions, except when the statute's been misapplied, in which case the court just says start it over, because that's an exception. So it's logically inconsistent. I think in order to get to that remedy, the court first needs to deal with the 2-year no extensions provision. And, you know, I think it's important for the court to also recognize that the 2-year period was, that Judge Rafferty found that the 2-year period was only the first part of 2083, that was only constitutional because of this court's rule. And, you know, that raises separate separation of powers issues, because the legislature can't delegate to this court the duty to, to enact statute of limitations. That would be the legislator's prerogative. They can't delegate that. I had wanted to yield the floor to direct appeal counsel, but I'm running out of time. I did note that Mr. Edwards went over by a couple of minutes. But maybe I'll try to address one other thing that I think is really important for the court. Two things. One, the 2 years can't be met in this case unless it can't be met and also have an appeal and do all the things that we're talking about. It's gone. You know, the 2 years is long gone. Second point, the way that the judge has currently refused to rule on whether or not it's jurisdictional on this court and how it affects this court, that creates an actual conflict of interest between post-conviction counsel and direct appeal counsel. Because every day that we take on this post-conviction, every single day that is devoted to post-conviction day under that interpretation is one day less that's available for the direct appeal. And that's a problem. And I think that was probably the essence of what direct appeal counsel would have argued. If the court were inclined to give direct appeal counsel a few minutes to address the court, may.
I think we've exhausted the time for the argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted, and the court will be in recess for 15 minutes.